Chapter 6. You're an unlucky lot. I believe there's a curse on you. I'll leave you this very day. Yes. I leave that poor Elsie too. I will. No good will ever come to you. Mr. Openshaw was utterly astonished at this speech, most of which was completely unintelligible to him, as may easily be supposed. Before he could make up his mind what to say, or what to do, Nora had left the room. I do not think he had ever really intended to send for the police to this old servant of his wife's, for he had never for a moment doubted her perfect honesty. But he had intended to compel her to tell him who the man was, and in this he was baffled. He was, consequently, much irritated. He returned to his uncle and aunt in a state of great annoyance and perplexity, and told them he could get nothing out of the woman, that some man had been in the house the night before, but that she refused to tell who he was. At this moment his wife came in, greatly agitated, and asked what had happened to Nora, for that she had put on her things in passionate haste, and had left the house. "This looks suspicious," said Mr. Chadwick. "It is not the way in which an honest person would have acted." Mr. Openshaw kept silence. He was sorely perplexed. But Mrs. Openshaw turned round on Mr. Chadwick with a sudden fierceness no one ever saw in her before. "You don't know Nora, Uncle. She is gone, because she is deeply hurt at being suspected. Oh, I wish I had seen her, that I had spoken to her myself. She would have told me anything." Alice wrung her hands. "I must confess," continued Mr. Chadwick to his nephew, in a lower voice, "I can't make you out. You used to be a word and a blow, and oftenest the blow first, and now, when there is every cause for suspicion, you just do not. Your Miss Suss is a very good woman, I grant, but she may have been put upon as well as other folk, I suppose. If you don't send for the police, I shall." "Very well," replied Mr. Openshaw, surlily. "I can't clear Nora. She won't clear herself, as I believe she might if she would. Only I wash my hands of it, for I am sure the woman herself is honest, and she's lived a long time with my wife, and I don't like her to come to shame. But she will then be forced to clear herself. That, at any rate, will be a good thing." "Very well, very well. I am heartsick of the whole business. Come, Alice, come up to the babies, they'll be in a sore way. I tell you, Uncle," he said, turning round once more to Mr. Chadwick, suddenly and sharply, after his eye had fallen on Alice's wan, tearful, anxious face, "I'll have none sending for the police after all. I'll buy my aunt twice as handsome a brooch this very day, but I'll not have Nora suspected, and my Miss Suss plagued. There's for you." He and his wife left the room. Mr. Chadwick quietly waited till he was out of hearing, and then aided to his wife. "For all Tom's heroics, I'm just quietly going for a detective, wench. Thou needst know not about it." He went to the police station, and made a statement of the case. He was gratified by the impression which the evidence against Nora seemed to make. The men all agreed in his opinion, and steps were to be immediately taken to find out where she was. Most probably, as they suggested, she had gone at once to the man, who, to all appearance, was her lover. When Mr. Chadwick asked how they would find her out, they smiled, shook their heads, and spoke of mysterious, but infallible ways and means. He returned to his nephew's house with a very comfortable opinion of his own sagacity. He was met by his wife with a penitent face. "Oh, master, I found my brooch. It was just sticking by its pin in the flounce of my brown silk that I wore yesterday. I took it off in a hurry, and it must have caught in it, and I hung up my gown in the closet. Just now, when I was going to fold it up, there was the brooch. I'm very vexed, but I never dreamt but what it was lost." Her husband muttering something very like, "Confound thee, and thy brooch too. I wish I'd never given it thee," snatched up his hat, and rushed back to the station, hoping to be in time to stop the police from searching for Nora. But a detective was already gone off on the errand. Where was Nora? Half mad with the strain of the fearful secret, she had hardly slept through the night for thinking what must be done. Upon this terrible state of mind had come Ilse's questions, showing that she had seen the man, as the unconscious child called her father. Lastly came the suspicion of her honesty. She was little less than crazy as she ran upstairs, and dashed on her bonnet and shawl, leaving all else, even her purse, behind her. In that house she would not stay. That was all she knew, or was clear about. She would not even see the children again, for fear it should weaken her. She feared above everything Mr. Frank's return to claim his wife. She could not tell what remedy there was for a sorrow so tremendous, for her to stay to witness. The desire of escaping from the coming event was a stronger motive for her departure than her soreness about the suspicions directed against her, although this last had been the final goad to the course she took. She walked away almost at headlong speed, sobbing as she went, as she had not dared to do during the past night for fear of exciting wonder in those who might hear her. Then she stopped. An idea came into her mind, that she would leave London altogether, and betake herself to her native town of Liverpool. She felt in her pocket for her purse, as she drew near the Euston Square station with this intention. She had left it at home. Her poor head aching, her eyes swollen with crying, she had to stand still, and think, as well as she could, where next she should bend her steps. Suddenly the thought flashed into her mind, that she would go, and find out poor Mr. Frank. She had been hardly kind to him the night before, though her heart had bled for him ever since. She remembered his telling her as she inquired for his address, almost as she had pushed him out of the door, of some hotel in a street not far distant from Euston Square. Thither she went. With what intention she hardly knew, but to assuage her conscience, by telling him how much she pitied him. In her present state she felt herself unfit to counsel, or restrain, or assist, or do aught else, but sympathize and weep. The people of the inn said such a person had been there, had arrived only the day before, had gone out soon after his arrival, leaving his luggage in their care, but had never come back. Nora asked for leave to sit down, and await the gentleman's return. The landlady, pretty secure in the deposit of luggage against any probable injury, showed her into a room, and quietly locked the door on the outside. Nora was utterly worn out, and fell asleep a shivering, starting, uneasy slumber, which lasted for hours. The detective, meanwhile, had come up with her some time before she entered the hotel, into which he followed her. Asking the landlady to detain her for an hour or so, without giving any reason beyond showing his authority which made the landlady applaud herself a good deal for having locked her in, he went back to the police station to report his proceedings. He could have taken her directly, but his object was, if possible, to trace out the man who was supposed to have committed the robbery. Then he heard of the discovery of the brooch, and consequently did not care to return. Nora slept till even the summer evening began to close in. Then up. Someone was at the door. It would be Mr. Frank, and she dizzily pushed back her ruffled gray hair, which had fallen over her eyes, and stood looking to see him. Instead, there came in Mr. Openshaw and a policeman. "This is Nora Kennedy," said Mr. Openshaw. "Oh, sir," said Nora, "I did not touch the brooch. Indeed I did not. Oh, sir, I cannot live to be thought so badly of." And very sick and faint, she suddenly sank down on the ground. To her surprise, Mr. Openshaw raised her up very tenderly. Even the policeman helped to lay her on the sofa, and, at Mr. Openshaw's desire, he went for some wine and sandwiches. For the poor gaunt woman lay there, almost as if dead with weariness and exhaustion. "Nora," said Mr. Openshaw, in his kindest voice, "the brooch is found. It was hanging to Mrs. Chadwick's gown. I beg your pardon. Most truly I beg your pardon, for having troubled you about it. My wife is almost broken-hearted. Eat, Nora, or, stay, first drink this glass of wine," said he, lifting her head, pouring a little down her throat. As she drank, she remembered where she was, and who she was waiting for. She suddenly pushed Mr. Openshaw away, saying, "Oh, sir, you must go. You must not stop a minute. If he comes back, he will kill you." "Alas, Nora, I do not know who he is. But someone is gone away who will never come back. Someone who knew you, and whom I am afraid you cared for." "I don't understand you, sir," said Nora, her master's kind and sorrowful manner bewildering her, yet more than his words. The policeman had left the room at Mr. Openshaw's desire, and they two were alone. "You know what I mean, when I say someone is gone who will never come back. I mean that he is dead."
"Who?"
said Nora, trembling all over. "A poor man has been found in the Thames this morning, drowned."
"Did he drown himself?"
asked Nora, solemnly. "God only knows," replied Mr. Openshaw, in the same tone. "Your name and address at our house were found in his pocket. That, and his purse, were the only things that were found upon him. I am sorry to say it, my poor Nora, but you are required to go and identify him."
"To what?"
asked Nora. "To say who it is. It is always done, in order that some reason may be discovered for the suicide, if suicide it was. I make no doubt he was the man who came to see you at our house last night. It is very sad, I know." He made pauses between each little clause, in order to try and bring back her senses, which he feared were wandering, so wild and sad was her look. "Master Openshaw," said she, "at last, I've a dreadful secret to tell you, only you must never breathe it to anyone, and you and I must hide it away forever. I thought to have done it all by myself, but I see I cannot. Yon poor man, yes. The dead, drowned creature is, I fear, Mr. Frank, my mistress's first husband." Mr. Openshaw sat down, as if shot. He did not speak. But, after a while, he signed to Nora to go on. "He came to me the other night, when God be thanked you were all away at Richmond. He asked me if his wife was dead or alive. I was a brute, and thought more of our all coming home than of his sore trial. Spoke out sharp, and said she was married again, and very content and happy. I all but turned him away. And now he lies dead and cold. God forgive me," said Mr. Openshaw.
"God forgive us all," said Nora.
"Yon poor man needs forgiveness perhaps less than anyone among us. He had been among the savages shipwrecked I know not what, and he had written letters which had never reached my poor missus. He saw his child. He saw her, yes. I took him up, to give his thoughts another start, for I believed he was going mad on my hands. I came to seek him here, as I more than half promised. My mind misgave me when I heard he had never come in. Oh, sir, it must be him." Mr. Openshaw rang the bell. Nora was almost too much stunned to wonder at what he did. He asked for writing materials, wrote a letter, and then said to Nora, "I am writing to Alice, to say I shall be unavoidably absent for a few days, that I have found you, that you are well, and send her your love, and will come home tomorrow. You must go with me to the police court. You must identify the body. I will pay high to keep name and details out of the papers."
"But where are you going, sir?"
He did not answer her directly. Then he said, "Nora, I must go with you, and look on the face of the man whom I have so injured, unwittingly, it is true. But it seems to me, as if I had killed him. I will lay his head in the grave, as if he were my only brother. And how he must have hated me. I cannot go home to my wife till all that I can do for him is done. Then I go with a dreadful secret on my mind. I shall never speak of it again, after these days are over. I know you will not either." He shook hands with her. And they never named the subject again, the one to the other. Nora went home to Alice the next day. Not a word was said on the cause of her abrupt departure a day or two before. Alice had been charged by her husband in his letter not to allude to the supposed theft of the brooch,
So she, implicitly obedient to those whom she loved both by nature and habit, was entirely silent on the subject, only treated Nora with the most tender respect, as if to make up for unjust suspicion. Nor did Alice inquire into the reason why Mr. Openshaw had been absent during his uncle and aunt's visit, after he had once said that it was unavoidable. He came back, grave and quiet, and, from that time forth, was curiously changed. More thoughtful, and perhaps less active, quite as decided in conduct, but with new and different rules for the guidance of that conduct. Towards Alice he could hardly be more kind than he had always been, but he now seemed to look upon her as someone sacred, and to be treated with reverence, as well as tenderness. He throve in business, and made a large fortune, one half of which was settled upon her. Long years after these events, a few months after her mother died, Ilse and her father, as she always called Mr. Openshaw, drove to a cemetery a little way out of town, and she was carried to a certain mound by her maid, who was then sent back to the carriage. There was a headstone, with FW and a date. That was all. Sitting by the grave, Mr. Openshaw told her the story, and for the sad fate of that poor father whom she had never seen, he shed the only tears she ever saw fall from his eyes. Asterisk, 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 a most interesting story, all through, I said, as Jarber folded up the first of his series of discoveries in triumph. A story that goes straight to the heart, especially at the end. But I stopped, and looked at Trottle. Trottle entered his protest directly in the shape of a cough. Well, I said, beginning to lose my patience. Don't you see that I want you to speak, and that I don't want you to cough? Quite so, ma'am, said Trottle, in a state of respectful obstinacy which would have upset the temper of a saint. Relative, I presume, to this story, ma'am?
Yes, yes, said Jarber.
By all means, let us hear what this good man has to say.
Well, sir, answered Trottle, I want to know why the house over the way doesn't let, and I don't exactly see how your story answers.
Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.